Welcome to the Criterion Correction. My name is Ed.
And I'm Dr. Bolsonaro Zed.
In this podcast, we'll be delving deep into the Criterion Collection of films, trying to figure out what exactly it says about cinema as a whole, and what makes a movie worthy of being added to the collection. Join us as we decide, should we collect them all? This week, we take a trip into the literally unknown regions of Brazil as we watch 2020's Bacurau. But before we get there, one of the featured players in Bacurau is Udo Kier, a noted character actor throughout the last about 50 years of film, and he has quite a filmography. So, Dr. Z, here is one of my patented games. And the object of the game is this a real film, or have I made it up? Are you prepared?
Oh, okay, I like this. I'm ready.
All right. So these are all films that either Udo Kier is in or films that I have made up for Udo Kier to be in. So let us start. The first film is Mark of the Devil, where Udo Kier is or is not Count Christian von Meru.
That's got to be real.
It is indeed real, from the early 1970s. All right. Next up, The Darkness on Strasse 17 as Hermann Röhm.
I'm also going to go with real on that one.
Nope, totally made that up. All right. Spermula as Werner.
I've got to go with real on that one.
You are indeed correct.
I had a feeling with a name like that you wouldn't be creative enough just to come up with that on your own.
I would love to say that I am. I am not. I would not in a million years have come up with that film. I now kind of bizarrely want... I read the plot description. I think it involves alien women and control of some way. So maybe I pick it for an off correction someday. All right, next up. The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne as Dr. Henry Jekyll.
Fake.
Nope, real.
What?
It is real. I do not know who Miss Osborne is and how she plays into the equation. At least they could have gone Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde. I mean, I recall correctly, it's from the 80s, so it was before that film actually existed.
I guess that's true. I mean, I'm curious, so yeah.
All right, next up, The Fall of Concrete Tears as Otto von Krupp.
Fake.
Yeah, all right, you got that one. It is indeed fake. What gave it away?
Concrete Tears. It sounds like a DMV movie. Red Pavement.
As in, like, propaganda for the DMV?
No, like those, you know, scared straight, you're not going to drive recklessly because you've seen horrifying images.
That's what I said, propaganda for the DMV.
Okay, true. Yeah, that's one.
All right, next up, Panko 95 as Johann Wolfgang Amadeus Zart.
Real?
Yes, it was apparently, from the plot description that's on IMDb, the film is from 1983, so before reunification, but it, I guess, posits that they didn't, German reunification, of course, so a thing that hadn't happened yet, it posits that it didn't happen, so what do I know? All right, next up, Twin Angel Devil Heart, where he plays Zoltan, the emissary of the devil.
Real?
Nope, wrong. Fake. Though he does at some other point play a character named Zoltan, which I found out after I had picked that as my made-up name, but I do not believe he is the emissary of the devil in that film. All right, three more. The Drone of Sadistic Bees as Baron Piotr Rangoon.
Real.
Nope, completely fake.
No. No, I thought that'd be a good B movie.
It would be a great B-movie, but it is a one that we'll have to make ourselves someday. And Udo Kier seems to take a lot of paychecks, so maybe we can get him for the film if we act quickly enough. All right. Three Shake-A-Leg Steps to Heaven, where he is Edward Muhlendorf.
Real?
Indeed real. I do not know why it is Shake-A-Leg Steps, but there it is.
It's a dance movie.
Sure. Udo Kier, noted ballroom dancer. And then, last but not least, The New Adventures of Pinocchio, in the dual roles of Madame Fambeau and Lorenzini.
I'll go with fake, even though I suspect I'm wrong.
You are indeed wrong. That is a real film where I do not know why he plays dual roles, nor do I know who Madame Fambo is, but I guess that is a thing that exists.
It is indeed, I guess, a thing that exists. Is that an animated film or?
It did not appear to be, though maybe that was his 20-year prior audition for the Pinocchio remake. But what won't ever be remade is poetic plot. This film takes place in Bacarao, which is absent from all maps right now, for Anglo-American shills come to get out their kills, but the town citizens have a much different vow. So, Dr. Z, in choosing this for our spooktacular, I framed this as being a horror film, as reading the description of it on the Criterion channel, that was my best guess as to what genre this fell into. I'm not entirely sure I was wrong in that determination, but nor am I entirely sure that I was correct either. So, granted that genre as a concept has immense limitations and only gives us a partial view of any given film, I still want to start off by asking, as a way of trying to figure out what we watched, what would you call the genre of Bacarao?
Oh, I think I read a review that did a good job of this. What's it called? A weird Western is the genre that Wikipedia apparently references it as.
And do you want to describe what that means?
Well, I'm not sure I know, but this was a weird Western. Essentially, there are a lot of parallels to the Western genre in terms of a town that comes under siege by outsiders. Some of those genre conventions are, I don't know if subverted. I guess there's some subversion there for sure, but it's also playing with different themes of colonialism. And here, it's weird because it throws so many different hints at you. Like, there's a drone that is made to look like a 1950s UFO. There's a very convoluted plot with strange, sinister, and ultimately less convoluted nature than you think. So it's interesting because you've got like this conflict there, but you also have this sense of like a cultural milieu piece, and it just balances a lot. So I think weird Western is one way of putting it, because you're focused on this settlement, this camp, this town, as it were.
I mean, I think you're probably pretty close to the mark in terms of what this falls into. One of the Letterboxd reviews I read by Matt Singer compared it to The Seven Samurai without the samurai. So by extension, also the Magnificent Seven without the Seven. This idea of a community under threat by outside forces. And while that's not necessarily inherent just to the Western genre, it's what we think of probably most often when we think of the Western. So yeah, that makes sense in terms of trying to peg what this was. But one of the things that struck me kind of getting through this is I had a good trouble in getting my arms around this. And one of the reasons I think I did was there's no real protagonist here. There's a certain antagonist or group of antagonists, and I guess if I'm saying that, I can say that the protagonist is the population of the town of Bacarao, but there's no one like focal point character that we're like following and trying to track their emotional journey throughout this.
And as you mentioned, in the description of this movie as The Seven Samurai without the samurai, what's unique about this is the idea of competence on the part of the townspeople. And we'll get into a little bit more of the reason for that later on. But the reason why it can thrive without a singular protagonist or a group of heroes to stave off the evildoers is that these are competent individuals. And that, I think, is making a point, because it's a very sort of, what's the word? It's a very on the margins place, first of all. So the population is marginalized. They are seemingly browbeaten by the governmental forces, corruption, inadequacy around them. But the individuals there have this sense of community and this savvy that allows them to see through a lot of the ploys. I mean, for example, that early on you see this weird looking UFO thing on screen kind of following, and you're sort of wondering what's going on. And the townspeople very quickly are like, it's a drone. It looks like a 1950s UFO, but it's a drone. So they have like this insight. And so I think that when it comes to protagonists, you have these characters and you have this way into the different elements of the town itself through these different kind of positionings. You've got Lunga, you've got Pecote, you've got Plinio, the doctor. It's character driven and sociological at the same time.
Yeah. And of course you forget Dominguez, who is kind of set up as kind of an antagonist because she goes to a woman's funeral and proceeds to loudly profane her memory. But then we just discover, oh no, she was drunk, and she's actually pretty cool throughout the rest of the film.
Yeah, that you've got this sense of real individuals with flaws. That this isn't, you know, an idyllic place where because they're off the beaten path, they're automatically just fantastic moral individuals. And I think you see that with, you know, the notion of Lunga as this freedom fighter whose methods are clearly achieving things, but there's a question about do the, you know, ends justify the means that he's employing. But you, how do I frame it this way? It's about the collective experiences of these individuals kind of fighting against in a very unfair system.
And I should note that some of the reading and listening I did on this film indicated that if you are steeped in the milieu of Brazilian politics, there is a lot here that kind of serves as commentary or allegory. Sadly, I am not one of those people. I know who Bolsonaro is and that he's bad and not much else. But even being removed from the particulars of what may be being referenced or commented on, the idea of a community fighting against a political and moral structure that is there to oppress them certainly crosses national boundaries.
I like the way that a lot of reviews treated this by saying that it is very much situated in its local context, that there is a lot of weight there to the history, and even in regards to something I like to do more research on, the notion of the history of like rebellions in Brazil, of civilian or I guess peasant uprisings in a sense, and it plays out so remarkably well both in that local context but also just the themes of global capitalism, the atrocities of the West sort of being laid upon the global South. It's a lot to grapple with, but it does carry a lot of weight in terms of handling, you know, the kinds of monstrous actions that people can do without really thinking about. And I think that's what really solidifies the antagonist, is that lack of genuine reflection or caring, that the entertainment value of this act of going out and hunting these individuals and treating it as though, oh, well, it doesn't matter because we're down here in this middle of nowhere place in this town that isn't even on the map anymore.
So tying in a couple of different points here, back to our discussion of genre, we get this kind of portrait of the town with like some harbingers of what's to come, but it really dives into its genre territory, as in genre film territory, about an hour in, where it becomes a variation on The Most Dangerous Game. So the idea of humans hunting other humans for sport, and that idea is made pretty explicit. But unlike most variations on The Most Dangerous Game, where it is the antagonists gathering the victims to them, here they are seeking out those victims. And you said that they're somewhere remote, they're not on the map. It's notable to say it's because they have been blocked from the map by the antagonists. So kind of that, that's not even really much of a metaphor, but that stand-in for kind of coming in and colonizing a new area that they can say they have discovered.
Well, even beyond that is just the ways in which you've got this sort of insidious nature of capitalism coming in and wreaking havoc on even the nation, because the individuals who sort of scout out the town are Brazilian, but they're from a more affluent part of Brazil. So they don't see themselves as part of the townspeople, and they want to be, you know, considered among the hunters, but they are not. Like, they are not part of that because the hunters are racist. No matter how much you bow down to the system and try to make it work for you in some way, shape, or form, it's that sense of degradation, the prejudice that comes along that's never going to be able to be overcome. And we see that when the hunting party kills their scouts and just treats them like any other part of this game, which is the dehumanizing values of this particular cohort.
And it bears noting that this racialized aspect is made quite explicit by the hunting party, where they make comments along the lines of, yeah, they could pass, but you could tell they're not white. And once they have decided that they are not white and therefore expendable, that's when the guns come out and they end up expiring. Now, the hunting party is not that great. As you also noted, it's not that the hunting party, the scouting party is that great either, because, I mean, they do have their own body count that they inflict, but even they are kind of pawns of the white Westerners, led by noted film villain, antagonist, and all-around reprobate Udo Kier.
Although I do like that one of the more despicable people in this movie is represented by, like, an HR rep.
Which one was the HR rep?
The one who murders the kid. That they make a point of it back there, because I think, you know, it's this idea that the prison guard, the one guy who's a prison guard, is sort of, like, really pissed off that this other guy murdered a child and kind of sees that as out of bounds. And Udo is like, oh, who would have thought that an HR representative would do this and a prison guard would, you know, fight against it? And so that was just a moment where I was like, oh, nice dig.
I'm probably fixating more on Udo Kier than I should, just because I've seen him in other things. But even he is interesting in that he is kind of decidedly amoral in all of this, because at a certain point he's not even really concerned about killing the townspeople of Bacarau. He just wants to kill anybody that he can end up getting his silencer around, and if townspeople don't present themselves, he'll just shoot anybody.
Oh yeah, he takes out one. I mean, he takes out at least one of his direct party members, and it's pretty clear that's what's going to happen as the siege goes down.
And so this idea of the immorality of the Westerners coming in and trying to terrorize this town, but the amorality of even the Westerners themselves and being so willing to eat their own.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big differences here, is the townspeople are really out to protect and help one another, that even in the face of the differences, because you get the feeling that Lunga is sort of an outcast at this point, that he's made his choices and there's some individuals who really are questioning those motives as a whole, or not motives, but questioning his means. But even when it comes down to this existential threat, that he's welcome back and really takes seriously the protection of this community, that it is about those ties that bind these individuals together.
And like, you get the feeling that Lunga is kind of like an exile at this point. I think early in the film, the person that we think is going to be the protagonist says something along the lines of, I wouldn't turn him in, so indicating there's some degree of loyalty in the town for him, but either like partly for his own good or partly for the town's good or a little bit of both, that he has removed himself from the day-to-day of the town until he's needed to come back and kind of lead the fight.
Well, this is really interesting to me, because of course you read into text what you are surrounded by, and I'm sort of struck by this as sort of this model of an anarchist commune, if that makes sense. And so if you're not familiar, anarchism is not the lack of order that it's typically portrayed as, that, you know, typically it's like, oh, anarchists are all just about like preserving themselves. It's really, if you look into it, more of an egalitarian system. And you see that in the way this town functions, that you have different individuals with different roles. It's all about sort of the egalitarian value, that even when you have I forget her name, but one of the prostitutes of the town who's taken by the mayor, that there's great concern for her well-being and her value to the community as like a person, that it's this interesting sense in which you've got these different roles that come out, despite the fact that they're not really part of an actual government structure, that they are a collective of individuals who are trying their best to work within their own means, to preserve one another, work towards helping one another, and fighting against this, you know, capitalistic system where people have, you know, likely paid a great deal of money to come on this hunting mission. And the implication is, you know, the Udos led others of these before that are just like, oh, we find these off the map places and go in and have fun.
Well, and then the idea that they're actively collaborating with the mayor over the region. Like, I kind of like the fact that they don't outline, like, step by step what kind of the plan is, but it seems pretty evident that the mayor probably nonplussed at the treatment he gets from the townspeople, accepted a payoff from these Westerners and said, hey, you can kill all of these people, which in itself is a very American Western kind of trope. The idea of power collaborating with mercenaries or criminals or what have you to solve a problem for them. And that then it's the town's people's responsibility to clean that up. And as I'm describing that, I realize that I also kind of just ascribed the plot to many Westerns, but notably Blazing Saddles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that is true. Well, I think it's also interesting, even the details that, you know, he drops off those drugs that are supposed to dim people's wits at the beginning there. And that, you know, that there's this calculated sense of yeah, that he's totally in on this as a whole. And it's a real accusation at government, just at the self-serving nature that so much governance ends up turning towards, that you've got these self-centered individuals who are really just focused on the next payout, and they're going to run the math and the metrics are going to be more important than anything else. The way the movie is, that plays out, I think is really impressive, that if you don't know what's going to happen in this film, it's amazing, just because the pieces are there, the hints are there, from the coffins at the very beginning to the drugs that are given / the drugs that are taken at the psychotropics at the funeral, that there's so much interesting just development here that happens in an organic way, that you get to meet this colorful cast of townspeople. And in the end, it is this cathartic vengeance against the system that has ravaged so many parts of the world. And you see this just in terms of like the death of children, which, again, here is a literal instance, but is clearly metaphorically representing the way in which these systems have disenfranchised so many.
Here's a question for you that I want to separate slightly from the film's quality, which I think is considerable, but you'll see hopefully why when I ask it. Do you think this has a future as a cult movie?
As a cult movie? Like, do you mean like a cult favorite, or do you mean like cult Heaven's Gate movie?
The former rather than the latter.
Oh, so like something that has just like a real underplayed significance?
More like something that, because as a Brazilian film, kind of by definition, it probably would ordinarily have limited viability in the American market as a film. But if you look at, and I'm blanking on examples of this that are foreign, but like, kind of like The Room or a Rocky Horror. Again, I'm not saying in terms of quality, but in terms of its kind of offbeat nature and kind of like, if I describe to you, so there's this film where tourists try to kill a town, but they all take psychotropic drugs and end up murdering them all. That sounds like it has the makings of a film that could have a cult built around it.
No, I don't think so. Not in the same way as The Room or Rocky Horror. And I think it's because despite some of the over-the-top nature of this film in terms of its effects and even some of its you know, dark humor elements, I think that there's a serious core here that would prevent it from, again, taking up the kind of cult status as something like The Room. And I know we're not talking about quality here, but just even in regards to, I think in terms of a cult movie that is used in activist circles, I think I could see that, where, you know, you've got this sense of here is a real poignant metaphor of the pillaging of these communities by self-centered, profit-driven, just assholes. And in that case, I could see it being taken up in those contexts, that this is a movie of a kind of resistance. And in that way, yes. In a Rocky Horror Picture Show, like, where it's like, oh, this is such a bizarre, kooky movie, the effects are, like, so strange. No, I don't see that.
Well, and I think I made a mistake in using those as comparisons, because in this, and again, I know we're not confused in terms of quality, but those examples I brought up are more cult as camp, and I definitely would not call this camp in the least. I know they exist, but I'm struggling to find examples of kind of more of what I am talking about. But I think you're right. I think it has a future as a cult movie in the vein that you're talking about. But yes, certainly not in the cult as camp category, and I did not mean to suggest otherwise.
I see it almost as like this is sort of, it's not the type that's going to get wide showings at screenings. It's going to be the type that has people gathering together in their homes to kind of watch it off the radar. That I could see it sort of circulating in that way.
We shall see what cult our listeners decide to found or not found based on this movie when we get to our final segment, Collect Them All or Collect Not at All. Is this a notable location, or should it be wiped off the map?
So I feel like I haven't done a great job conversationally talking about this movie, because it is a powerful film. I'd recommend that you don't go in knowing too much, which if you've listened to this already, then shucks, I'm sorry. Even then, you'll still be able to appreciate it. The film has a message to it, and I really appreciated how it turned the tables, especially revealing that this unassuming, sort of sleepy appearing town was actually a haven of activism in the past, and really draws upon its legacy as this area of resistance, so that when they're invaded, it's everyone knows their part, everyone's concerned about the safety of the citizens of the town, and they thoroughly take their vengeance on these intruders. And what's interesting is that, like, even in the midst of it, for the first two, I guess what we would like to call the hunting party, when they get killed, that there's still sympathy given to them by the townspeople, or at least, you know, some sort of like care and attempts to save the one's life. And it just shows the humanity of this location, of this place, of these people, in opposition to the inhumanity of this kind of global corporatized system. The implication is these people have money, and so they're allowed to do whatever they want. And that is a powerful and often true statement that is hard to take. It's hard on the palate. So a movie like Baccarat is great fun from a filmmaking point and from enjoying it that way, but it's also seriously cathartic in breaking down those tropes. And rather than having the samurai run to the rescue, you've got the town people all in this, and they can take care of themselves. So it's a keep for me. It's a collect. It's a great film.
Well spoken. And for me, Baccarat is almost indescribable by its very design, and within the confines I've described, I do welcome its its future status as a cult movie, though I certainly would not want it marginalized or brought into camp status by that status. I wish I knew more about the political climate of Brazil, as I'm sure it would unlock so much more of the film for me. But in terms of what I was able to access, I found it fascinating in its shifting tones, shifting viewpoints, and shifting genres. It's not often we get so close to the present on the main show, but I'm glad we were presented with this film. And if our listeners would like to tell us how we're doing in the present, how can they do so, Dr. Z?
Oh, they can reach out to us on Instagram here at Critical Correction. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, future suggestions for movies. Also, if you want to help support the show, we'd ask that you go to iTunes and leave us a rating and review. Can't overstate how much that would help us. So again, if you'd like to help spread the word, go there, do that. And don't forget to subscribe.
And what will we be watching next week, Dr. Z?
Well, next week, as part of our spooky, go for it.
Spooktacular!
I meant the spooky part, but yeah.
Spooky!
There we go. Spectacular. We're going to be watching Ben Wheatley's Sightseers. So let's look forward to that. You can find it on the Criterion channel.
All right. Well, for the Criterion Correction, my name's Ben Ed.
I've been Dr. Bolsonaro should ride off on a donkey's head.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.